From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the Bible tells it, Noah was not so far from the beginning of creation, just 10 generations. You can read his descent back to Adam and Eve. But things were already a mess on Earth when Noah was almost 600 years old, as the Bible tells it. The Lord said, "Build an ark." In children's stories, it's cute. If you think about it, it's scary. In the new film, Noah, it's apocalyptic, and humankind almost ends right there. This hour on Point, the story of Noah and the Great Flood. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you hear this story today? Have you seen the film? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the scene from the new film Noah, where Noah, played by Russell Crowe, plants the last seed from the Garden of Eden that will sprout the forest Noah needs to build an ark.
The great flood is coming. The waters of the heavens will meet the waters of the earth. We build a vessel to survive the storm. We build an ark.
It's a dark story, a rough story, and humankind almost does not come out the other side. With us now to look at all this from San Francisco, Ingrid Lilly, an Old Testament scholar and executive producer of the website floodofnoah.com, which looks at the religious and cultural history of the flood story. She's a visiting scholar at the Pacific School of Religion's Graduate Theological Seminary. Ingrid Lilly, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And with us from North Haven, Connecticut, is Joel Bodden, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies at the Yale Divinity School. Joel, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to say right off the bat, this isn't an ad for the film. I saw it over the weekend for the show. I found it kind of tedious and ponderous and gloomy, and it wasn't my cup of tea. But it is interesting, the story itself in the Bible and the stakes here. But let me just, I think both of you have seen it, and I just wanted to get your reaction, Joel, first to you. What did you make of this telling of this story?
To be perfectly honest, I went in with fairly low expectations. Because when was the last time a good biblical movie was made? But I ended up actually enjoying the movie quite a lot, mostly because I wasn't hoping for it to be or expecting it to be a exact rendering of the biblical account, which frankly would be boring and totally free of any dialogue. But going into it thinking this is a new telling of the flood myth as opposed to of the biblical story, I found it actually compelling and challenging in really interesting moral ways.
Joel Bodden finds it interesting, challenging. Ingrid, how about you?
I probably came in with the opposite expectation. I had been reading so much about Aronofsky and the film, and I was excited about seeing the story of Noah in the hands of an artist, somebody who was willing to connect the biblical text to new issues that we face today. There were things that surprised me, and I was excited by those surprises. I did feel, for myself, being a biblical scholar and thinking about this text as deeply as I have, I found myself constantly coming back to the question, is he interpreting things the way I would? And so that sometimes took me out of the film, but overall I thought it was an exciting way to see the Bible come to life in the modern world.
Ingrid, we've got you as a Christian scholar of the Bible. Joel Bodden, you as a Jewish scholar of the Bible. I mean, what about this question, which is central to the movie, of whether or not mankind, humankind, should survive the flood? It struck me as almost like the Abraham and Isaac story shoved very hard into the middle of this tale. And yet, when I went back in Genesis, and, you know, there it is, right in the first book of the Old Testament, not, as you say, Joel, not a very long story, but right in there, God seems to be a little confused, too, if I may be so bold. I mean, part of it seems to say humans will also be wiped out because they're wicked, and then before it's over, that's all turned around. What about that tension in the film, Joel?
Yeah, it's a very interesting moment, both in the Bible and in the film. What is the purpose of the flood? Obviously the overarching question. In the Bible, there's really no doubt, even from the very beginning, that Noah and humanity are to survive and are to take all the animals along with them. But what is it about Noah that makes him you know, survivable.
No, but can I just ask you about that? Because I'm looking at the text right here, and it says, "The Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, the creatures." Doesn't seem so clear to me that survival is on the plan sheet there.
Well, he, you know, God also says to Noah, you know, take the animals on board, you know, to preserve life. So there's definitely a tension. I mean, there is something wrong with the world. And it's not clear in the Bible also, it's not clear whether it's the fault of humanity or whether it's the fault of the deity, right? So that by the end of the story, the conclusion of the story is not, and all the people were now better from now on.
Right.
Humanity has not changed at the end of the biblical story. It's God who has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's God who changes his mind and says, you know what? Humanity is what it is. And it seems to me that there's nothing I can do about it. It's inherent in human nature to be bad to a certain degree. And I, God, am going to have to live with it and to a certain extent give them a way of managing their nature in a way that they that I didn't allow them before.
And it's right there, the symbol for this, there's a new sort of pact here, or deal, covenant is the word. The rainbow in the sky, supposedly from the biblical telling, the symbol of this, I'm not going to wipe you out. I'm not going to do that again. But going in, Ingrid, it's not hard to see where Daniel Aronofsky got his idea, because at the beginning of the telling in Genesis, God seems pretty straightforward about the fact that everything's going to be wiped out.
Yeah, I'm looking right here at the beginning of Genesis where God says, and you quoted it, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air. I am sorry that I made them. The next verse is so interesting because it says, but Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. So we're, exactly as Joel was saying, we're given to think about what merits this one person to be saved. But in the Hebrew, it would have been, you could read it, but Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord, or you could say, and Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. If you read it that second way, it's not clear. I love, Aronofsky forced me to think about this. Is it possible to read this text in the way Aronofsky has and read it along with his main character, who thinks everybody, including himself and his family, should be destroyed because humans are the problem, not just everybody else except for Noah and his family, this one righteous person? So I think this question of whether humanity as a whole, even Noah and his family, should not be part of the divine plan and should be eradicated from the face of the earth. This was an extremely interesting question, I think, the film posed, and forced me to come back to the Genesis text asking that question.
I want to dig on. Oh, yes, please, Joel.
There is a traditional Jewish interpretation of this part of the text where the line that Noah was righteous in his generation is taken not to mean that Noah was righteous, but that it was a really bad generation.
Relatively speaking,
happened to be the best of the lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think
the film actually plays with that in interesting ways, right? Noah is as violent as any of his opponents in this film. Certainly, he comes very close to being so.
Well, they show him resisting, trying not to be. But yeah, when the chips are down, he'll do what's necessary.
He sure kills a bunch of people in some scenes in this movie.
Yeah. I don't remember that from the Bible reading.
No, I know.
He's good with
a weapon.
Right. Yes, it's a blockbuster. Ingrid, what about the Bible talks about wickedness, and the Lord is not happy with this wickedness. In the film, the wickedness is essentially environmental degradation. They say explicitly at the top of the film that the descendants of Cain built this industrial, they use the word industrial, kind of, you know, mega problem that leaves the earth just scarred and barren practically. There's all kinds of wickedness you could point to. What about Aronofsky? Yeah. The film's pointing almost singularly at environmental destruction.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. The cities of Cain were meant to hear the curse of Cain when we hear about cities and Cain. And, you know, the plundering of the earth and the plundering of people, each other.
But it's not lying and cheating and fornicating that they make
it's
much of here.
It's not lying and cheating and fornicating.
It's the destroyed earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's how humans treat animals with disrespect. It's how they plunder one another to benefit themselves. It's very selfish. And you know, Aronofsky really hones in on this word dominion, this issue that human beings have taken the command to have dominion over the earth a little bit too far, and he reads it environmentally. He reads environmentally and also socially how human beings incarcerate each other. So there are sort of seemingly innocent victims in the cities of Cain who are thrown into pits and made to starve. So there is sort of this critique, I think, of how human beings dwell on the earth, how we interact with our environment, how we treat one another. But yes, it's not the wickedness in Genesis is so open; it could be anything. Your imagination is left to think. Well, what is this? Every inclination of the thought of their heart was only evil continually.
The movie makes it really kind of an environmentalist fable. We'll look at that and much more. Two wonderful theologians with us to look at the story of Noah and the Great Flood. Number one at the box office over the weekend. Not my favorite, but a very interesting story in the Bible itself and in the theater for the moral issues it raises. Music from the movie here, Noah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the story of Noah, his ark, and the Great Flood, the Bible story, and the way we hear it and see it now. Noah, the movie in theaters this weekend, number one in box office. Lots of people have seen it. We're joined by Joel Baden, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies at Yale Divinity School, author of The Promise to the Patriarchs, The Historical David, and Ingrid Lilly joins us from San Francisco, Old Testament scholar there, executive producer of floodofnoah.com, visiting scholar at the Pacific School of Religion Graduate Theological Seminary, and author of Women's Bible Commentary and the two books of Ezekiel. Here's a little bit from the film. Noah is here, and also figure Tubal-Cain. This is his arch nemesis in the film, King of the Descendants of Cain, played by Ray Winstone. He confronts Noah, played by Russell Crowe, to find out what is this thing he's building.
When I heard talk of miracles, I dismissed them. But then I saw the birds with my own eyes, and I had to come.
There isn't anything for you here.
No. This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
The worldly king thinks it's a stronghold. It's an ark. We know what will go down. It's got some twists in it. Here's the director, Darren Aronofsky. This was over the weekend, saying that the film has something for everyone and is true to the Bible. This was on CBS This Morning Saturday.
Most people think of their grandma's biblical epic. I mean, I love Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments, but it's been 50 years since a biblical epic's been on the screen, so we wanted to do something really new and really fresh. So for people, non-believers, it's something, you know, it's a great action film with a great family drama. But there's actually nothing in the film that contradicts the Bible. What we did is because it's only four chapters long, we were incredibly truthful to every single word that's in there and tried to breathe life into it and to bring it to life for 21st century audiences.
Truthful to every single word. There's been some pushback on that. Ken Ham, a well-known creationist, he debated Bill Nye on evolution recently, the science guy. He talked here with Roger Patterson of a group called AIG here they are talking about what bothered them about the new film Noah.
It is so, it's not just unbiblical, it's anti-biblical. And there's an environmental agenda. There's an agenda, I think, to make Noah out to be a very, you know, well, a psychopathic murderer, basically. And there's that agenda to undermine scripture and to attack. I mean,
there's an evolutionary agenda. Yeah, we need to talk about that.
Yeah. Tommy, remember, I was sitting beside you and I said, did I just see that?
Oh, boy. Talk about wickedness. Ingrid, did you see an anti-biblical, unbiblical agenda here?
Gosh, I think the word Bible means so many different things to so many different groups. For Ken Ham and his group, the Bible, he's a young earth creationist. He thinks the world began 6,000 years ago. And so for him, the flood and the flood geologists, they think they read the strata of the earth as having been impacted by the flood historically. So they're going to have certain issues with the film. There's another group that I think deserves mention. African-American Christians have been very upset that Aronofsky completely misrepresented the story of Ham and the curse of Canaan, which for centuries justified slavery.
This is one of Noah's sons. And what's the connection to slavery?
Oh, just that at the end, Noah, after in the scene, Aronofsky does depict this where he's lying drunk and Ham comes in and
sees
him.
This is after the flood, after the waters have receded. In the movie, they're on some, looks like, I don't know, Hawaiian Island or something, and Noah's laying drunk on the beach.
Looks pretty good. new wine. And Ham comes in and sees his father, and the other two sons are respectful enough to avert their eyes and cover him. And when Noah comes out of his drunken stupor, he doesn't curse Ham, he curses Ham's son Canaan. But he curses him with being a slave to the other two races, essentially. And the racial component of this story is not told. And so I think that's actually a more interesting critique of the film because it leaves out the sort of the history of the reception of this story and the powerful way in which this particular verse and this particular episode was used to justify slavery in this country even. The Bible means a lot of different things to different groups, and we can give energy towards Ken Ham and his interpretation. I think it's a minority interpretation. I think there are a lot of different ways in which this is both biblical and not biblical for different groups.
Joel Baden, as a Jewish interpreter of the Bible scholar, do you see a film that undermines or attacks Scripture here?
Attacks? No, I don't think. Attack, I think, requires some intention to render it somehow wrong. I do, however, not so much as a Jewish scholar, just as a biblicist, I do think that there is some value to the critique of the environmental message. Not that there's anything wrong with the environmental message of Aronofsky, but it is really very much not a part of the Bible. What he does leave out, I mean, he says he included almost everything, but he's left out some relatively important points that help him to make his environmental message. In the Bible, it's not that humans have been, particularly wicked, at least no more so than the animals, right? What God says in the Bible is all flesh, which includes the animals, has corrupted its way on the earth, right? That is, the Bible, actually, like Aronofsky, needs a reason for the animals to die. In the Bible, it's because they were violent as well.
Yeah.
The animals were violent also.
Red in tooth and claw. I mean, not quoting here, but that's kind of the idea.
Right. Aronofsky leaves out any guilt on the part of the animals. I mean, there's even a point where, they say, why are the animals innocent? And Noah says, they still live as they did in the garden. Well, that's definitely not the biblical story. The biblical story also, I have to say, for all the pro-vegetarian and climate change message of the movie, the biblical story ends with Noah taking some of the animals he brought in the ark, killing them, offering them as a sacrifice. And when God smells the burning animal flesh, he promises, I'm never going to do this again. To me, that's not such a pro-vegetarian message,
no.
per se. This is a movie that, again, with the animals, it depicts humans dying in somewhat graphic ways, but it never shows any of the animals dying, even though, millions and millions of animals, theoretically innocent ones, also have to die in the waters of the flood.
Oh, yeah. There's a wild chaos of death that's suggested here and glimpses of it. And he's very well aware that it means lots of humans and lots of creatures will die. But on the boat, fairly well safe. Ingrid, I hear you there.
Oh, just I want to affirm what Joel said. I was really, as a biblicist also, I was shocked that he didn't try to tackle the sacrifice at the end. That was not dealt with in the film, and it was in order to preserve this reading of the animals being innocent. I don't think he could have Noah and his family then start to eat meat. Not enough had changed in Aronofsky's version, but in the biblical version, meat is now permitted. It's the first thing granted. After the flood.
I mean, not only that, you said there's this going back and forth over the issue of dominion, but in Genesis, When you get to chapter 9, God is saying to humans after the flood, makes a new deal, that the covenant here, be fruitful and increase and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth, all the birds of the sky. I mean, it seems like right here in the story of Noah, the dominion's given back in full, Ingrid.
Wow, yeah, that's a great observation.
I now give you everything.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating, though, in the biblical literature, we're talking about Genesis, but the animals in biblical literature, there is more attention to their sort of role in the biblical worldview. So God makes a covenant with all flesh, including the animals that were on the ark, which I think is very interesting. It means that not only humanity, but animals as well are included in the first covenant.
Right. Never again will I destroy all living creatures as I've done. But humans get the best of that covenant as described in the Bible.
I want to just make a point, though. Mm. There are different covenants that are made with animals in the wisdom literature, in the Psalms. We get this impression that God kind of has another deal going with animals. So, yes, I agree that what you just said, that dominion is almost doubled down in how God speaks to Noah after the flood occurs. But the biblical literature itself has a lot of complex understandings of what animals are and what their role is in the natural order that I don't think that verse just covers. I think it's more complex than that.
Here's another short scene from the film Noah, Russell Crowe again, talking with his children about the task he's been charged with by the Creator.
Our family has been chosen for a great task, to save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why are they innocent?
Because they still live as they did in the garden.
Yes. And we need to save enough of them to start again.
But what of us?
I guess we get to start again too, in a new and better world.
I guess we get to start again, too, in a new and better world. But that becomes a very tested thesis before this is over. Ingrid Lilly, Joel Baden, please stand by. Lots of listeners with their own questions and observations. Luke in Trumbull, Connecticut. Luke, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is for your guests. Like, a lot of the Bible was written in accordance to the historical context of what was going on to the writers at the time. So I'm just wondering if there is any historical or biblical scholarly consensus on what the historical context was that, you know, made them write the Noah story. Because I know a lot of the other Mesopotamian religions also have, like, a flood story. And I'm assuming that there's some larger context in which all that was written, not just the flood itself, but, you know, the reasons for it from a, you know, humanistic standpoint.
Yeah, Luke, thank you very much for your call. Joel, I'll come first to you. What's this story doing in the Bible?
Sure. The caller is absolutely right. The flood story is a well-known tradition from all over the world, but particularly in the context of Israel, right? Mesopotamia has a great abundance of a variety of flood stories. In fact, many of the stories in those first few chapters of Genesis, the first 11, are stories that the creation account in Genesis 1 and the flood story and the Tower of Babel, which is effectively a story about Mesopotamia. These are stories that are borrowed from the cultural milieu. In all of the flood stories in Mesopotamia and in Israel, what's the value of them is that they are explanatory for the state of humanity as it is right now. Right? That is, why is it that we need no longer fear this inundation? Why is it that we are meat eaters, right? Which, I guess, again, goes against Aronofsky's film. But the story has a value in sort of saying there was a time before, and there is the era that we're living in right now. And the flood is the sort of new beginning of our current sort of historical era. Aronofsky, I should say, really wants the flood to bring about a return to Eden. Right. I think that's very, very clear in the movie, but that's absolutely not what the biblical story is about. The biblical story is about we can never go back to Eden. There's a new sort of divine regime, new laws, new accommodations to human nature. And so the flood story works to explain that cross-culturally, and I think that's explains a lot about what it's doing in the Bible. This is the beginning of our sort of cultural standards.
Ingrid, how do you see this? I mean, many cultures have flood stories. Here's the Bible's flood story. And our caller wonders, I think, you know, in part, are they referencing something that's historical? Is it purely functional, as Joel Baden describes it here? How do you see it?
I think I would tend to read with Joel that it's somewhat, that it's fairly functional. I do think, though, that we haven't gotten into this, and it's sort of complicated to explain for people who aren't familiar with it, but that the Genesis story has, there's actually two different stories spliced together. And it's hard for probably both Joel and I to separate out, to talk about Genesis without thinking about those two stories, because they're both doing different things.
Which two?
But one is called the Yahwist story. And it shares more in common with some of the earliest flood stories of Mesopotamia and Sumer. And then the second story, and you really can pull these apart and see them, you can read them as almost complete flood stories. So the biblical authors took them and mashed them together, put their details, like splicing
them. You mean To
make the Noah story, mm-hmm. That's right. The second layer is attributed to a priestly author who is writing much later. And I, to answer the caller's question, I'd like to refer to that particular telling, because that's the one that I think is really apocalyptic. The priestly writer imagines that the entire cosmos collapses, or at least that water floods the entire inhabitable world, and something cosmic is going on. And most biblical scholars would date the priestly author to the exile or post-exilic period, where Israel itself is dealing with a complete end to their society at the hands of war, at the hand of the sort of ancient Mesopotamian empires, Babylonia and Assyria, coming and destroying them. So the apocalyptic tones of the flood story, I think, you can connect them. Again, I would do it somewhat functionally. You can connect them to the kind of cataclysm, political and sort of just cataclysm of society that occurred for the ancient Israelites.
I mean, going back and reading for me just some of the very simple details, like the fact that it wasn't just two by two. Some of the sort of favorite animals there, they had seven pairs of each, I think, Ingrid, moving into the ark.
That's right. Yeah. And it's that detail when I've worked with students, most all of us as professors work with students with these texts. And as you start to ask them to see these details that don't quite match up, and that's one of the best ones. The command is given twice. One, come onto the ark with two by two, and then a second time, bring seven of the seven pairs of clean animals, not two by two. And so that the seven pair is usually considered, is attributed to that Yahwist or J layer that's earlier. But there are other details that don't mesh up as well, like how long the flood lasts, what the name of God is. These might not sound like compelling reasons to think of them as two stories, but I really think it comes across when you look at these two stories side by side. You can see that the biblical authors have more than one flood tradition.
A much darker telling in the new film Noah than in a lot of children's books, that's for sure. Rise and shine behind us here, Paul Zimm, all about that the sort of cute two-by-two and the rainbow at the end. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
So Noah, he built him. He built him an arky, arky. So Noah, he built him. He built him an arky, arky. Made it out of hickory, barky, barky. Children of the Lord. So rise and shine and give God your glory, glory. Rise and shine and give God. Rise and shine and give God your glory, glory, children of the Lord.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of Noah, his ark, and the great flood, the Bible story, and the way we hear it and see it now. Ingrid Lilly is with us from San Francisco, Old Testament scholar there. Joel Baden is with us from North Haven, Connecticut, and Yale Divinity School. It wasn't so long ago that we had much more light-hearted renderings of the Noah story. Here is Bill Cosby on the Jack Parr Tonight Show way back in 1962 about that Noah conversation with the Lord.
Noah, who is that?
It's the Lord, Noah.
Right. Where are you? What do you want? I've been good.
I want you to build an ark.
Right. What's an ark?
A very young Bill Cosby in a much lighter telling. And here's Russell Crowe last week talking with Good Morning America's Robin Roberts about critics of the film, saying they've been too quick to judge.
You know, we've had probably over a year now of very harsh criticism from a bunch of people who have put their name and stamp on an opinion that's not even based on the movie or seeing the movie, just an assumption of what it could be or how bad it could be or how, you know, wrong it could be in their eyes, you know, which, you know, I think, quite frankly, is bordering on absolute stupidity, you know, because now people are seeing the movie and they're realizing how respectful it is and how potent it is, you know.
Well, some are going with that and some are not. Ingrid Lilly, Joel Baden, let's go to our callers. Terry, Milwaukee, calling. Hi, Terry, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I did see the movie on Friday night.
Yeah.
And I understand that Hollywood, since its creation, has been taking liberties with a lot of history. And that's just the way Hollywood is. But when you look at this movie, to say that it follows the account of the Bible is grossly incorrect.
Why? How, Terry?
For example, they've got these rock-like creatures that are helping Noah build the ark. When you read the Bible account, the Bible account talks about angels forsaking their place in heaven, materializing as men, having sex with human women, giving birth to Nephilim or bullies. These rock-like creatures were demons in violation of God's universal laws. They weren't sent to Earth to protect Adam and Eve or do something to help them. And there's no account in the Bible that ever talks about demon angels helping Noah build the ark. I could go on and on with a litany of other comments and statements.
Terry, what did you think about Noah's anguish over whether or not humanity should survive the flood?
There was no question in the Bible account that Noah was placed in that ark with his family, and those three sons, by the way, took onto the ark three wives, which was not depicted in the movie. And the seven animals, the comment about the seven animals, they took extra animals on for sacrifice. When that ark hit land, Noah was instructed to provide animal sacrifices. If he'd only taken two of each, as he starts sacrificing animals, in pure worship to the God of the Bible, he would have been destroying types of animals.
Yeah, Terry, we've got it. I don't know if I saw the sacrifice command in regard to the seven pairs, but clearly two of each of some and seven pairs of others. What about these Nephilim, Joel Baden? I mean, these in the movie, for people who haven't seen it, there are these kind of transformer creatures made of stone, and it's explained that they're angels who were thrown to Earth, and they didn't behave properly, so they were bound in stone, and they turn out being sort of building cranes and mega builders for Noah, this giant ark. Super liberty there, Joel?
Well, super dexterity for rock people, I got to tell you. I mean, what we should say about these rock creatures who are in the movie referred to as the Watchers is that they are not in the Bible. This is true. They are, however, an incredibly old tradition. It emerges out of really ancient, 2,000-plus-year-old Jewish tradition that talks about these creatures called the Watchers that come up in a are described in a book that didn't make it into our biblical canon, a book called Enoch, attributed to Noah's great-grandfather, who is referred to in the movie. So, yes, these are not in the Bible, and obviously Aronofsky has taken great liberty with what he can do with them. They really take on a life of their own. They are a major character in the film in a way that they are in ways different from the ancient tradition still. But I think that we need to be careful about saying it's not exactly the biblical story. What he's done, especially with the Watchers, is drawn on this really ancient stream of Jewish and Christian and biblical interpretive tradition that has, over centuries and millennia, provided this rich background material for the Bible as a whole, right? since the Bible was written, gaps have been filled in many interesting and different ways. And we fill gaps the same way every time we read the story. So Aronofsky is not doing something sort of radical. He's actually participating very clearly, I think, in a 2,000-plus-year tradition of adding to and expanding on and filling in gaps in the story in order to make it compelling and give it meaning appropriate to the teller.
Wow, in this case, that suggests that 2,000 years from now, maybe the movie becomes part of some kind of understanding. That's interesting. Christopher, in Calabasas, California. Christopher, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have two things. One is that it strikes me that the God of the Old Testament is essentially insane. He loves the Jews, a plague upon them. He loves Abraham, kill your son. Job, another example. The God of the Old Testament is just doesn't play fair. The other thing I want to say is that it strikes me that Noah's qualification for being the savior of humanity, as it is that he's willing to undertake a task of incomparable size. He's willing to do this essentially as a great manifestation of his faith and belief in his past. And I think that that's what saves him.
Christopher, the line is a little rough, but I think we've got the gist of it. I do want to pick that up. Let me hang on to it and get one more right here. I appreciate your call. We will take it up. Norma in Burrillville, Rhode Island. Norma, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a question that may not, well, it pertains to the subject of the movie, not necessarily the movie. And I'm honored to have biblical scholars there to ask this question that I've had all my life. The question is that if God was all-knowing and all-powerful prior to even creating the earth, then he knew every action and thought that every human would be doing forever from the time he created. Yet he went ahead and created knowing that man would not be perfect. Yet in the beginning, especially in the Old Testament, he has many genocidal acts. Could they, as scholars, try to explain to me how they justify an all-knowing God, knowing that people were not going to be perfect, yet he went ahead and, you know, he created these genocides, which will apparently, again, will be in the New Testament.
Okay, Norma, thank you. Okay, Ingrid, Joel, we got a lot on the table now here. This fierce God. And Joel, let me bring that one first, too, and I'll bring it to you as well, Ingrid, but you hear our caller in California calling this God essentially insane. He creates the Jews and the humankind, and then he's, you know, cutting people down. And then Norma says, if this God in the Bible is all knowing, what's up with his not anticipating just how badly things could go wrong, so badly that he wants to wipe it all out, Joel?
Yeah. So I think the second point is actually is a much easier one to address, although perhaps harder to hear, which is, the God of the Old Testament is not all-knowing in the way that we think of it today, right? In the way that the caller put it, in terms of being able to see everything that's going to happen in advance. The way that God of the Old Testament is all-knowing is knows what's happening right now, right? Mm-hmm. It's very hard to escape from God's eye right now. But the idea of the omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent deity is very much a non-Old Testament kind of view of God.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's very much wrapped up in Greek philosophy, and it really comes to the fore later. And we take it so for granted now that we want to read it back into the Bible, and then we're challenged by the biblical depiction of a God who seems to not know exactly what's going to happen.
And the Noah story
on.
In particular, he's saying, oh, I made all this, and it's a mess. I want
this
to start
a story,
again.
This is a story where God says, oops.
Yeah.
And God says, I did it wrong, right? I expected more than I should have out of my creations. This is not a God who knew what was coming down the pipeline.
Ingrid, the human side of that equation, which whether you're religious or not, you read this and you can see this kind of philosophical wrestling. Here's this creation, and it appears to be so flawed. Or if you look at it in religious terms, Lord, you made this, and it's so flawed. What's the meaning of this? Noah wrestles with this in the movie.
I exactly as Joel has said, we have these expectations about who God is, and then but there really are a variety of characterizations of God in the Old Testament, and I think we fail to read the Old Testament well if we try to harmonize them into one characterization. The issue of one thing that I think can sort of salvage often with my students, I taught in Kentucky for a number of years, mm-hmm. with a lot of students who venerate the Bible in sort of an evangelical kind of way. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting that comes across, yes, God might not know everything, and he may see exactly, as Joel said, what happens exactly right now. But it invites this kind of relational moving forward that God requires. This is especially true in the earlier layer that I was talking about earlier, that God requires the participation of humans. It's the sacrifice at the end that changes God's heart and says, I won't do this again to you.
This is the animal sacrifice they make once land is dry again and they're settled, and God smells the smoke of the sacrifice.
That's right. That's the event that changes God's mind and puts him back into relation with humans in a new way. And I love to point out, I don't know if this is extraneous, but I think it's so beautiful. In the Genesis 2 account of the creation of humanity, God creates Noah and then experiments. He says, I'm going to give you a partner.
You mean,
and he creates all these
Adam, you mean to say.
He creates mm-hmm. Adam. Mm-hmm. The one human, and then he experiments by giving him possible helpmates, possible mates, and he starts with the animals. Do you like the cow? Do you like the elephant? No, none of these are working. And so it's Adam who says, this is the one, and God has been sort of trying all along to see if he could please his creature. And so there's this, in that particular strata of the Old Testament literature, you have this relationality that I think is very compelling, I think, to modern readers.
I mean, Ingrid, in the movie, it's very relational in this way that, you know, the creator, as they say in the movie, doesn't speak. Noah sort of gets these ideas, and then here he is on the ship, and when he's trying to decide whether or not to extinguish humanity by, I won't get into much of the details, but it would be bloody, and he decides not to. It almost seems like he's in some kind of conversation with the deep. It gets into these notions of there are moments in the film where he seems sort of like a Jim Jones fanatic here, and he's prepared to bring it all down.
He does. I think the film is asking, you know, you're right, God doesn't speak. Noah, the character of Noah, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, speaks to God through dreams, which is quite biblical. There's a number of places in the biblical literature where the patriarchs or the main characters receive knowledge about God's interaction with humans through dreams. So Noah receives this information through dreams, and then he has to discern what that dream means. And he becomes very committed to his interpretation of his dream. Methuselah, his grandfather, questions him and tries to help him come to a full understanding of what it is that he is supposed to do. But when he becomes a bit sort of homicidal and maniacal, I think as Glenn Beck put it, maniacally homicidal, he's really still obeying his perception or his interpretation of what that calling is on his life. And I think that the film does sort of ask people to step back and wonder where does the certainty of their religious conviction come from? And for Noah, it came from this interpretation of sort of needing to complete the task, as he put it.
Joel, I wonder what you think of the depiction of, in a sense, gender roles. Quite clearly in the film, Noah's prepared to take his understanding of what he thinks God wants and, you know, go all the way with it, even to ending humanity. The women in the film absolutely oppose this. Is this a Daniel Aronofsky gender role assignment or something else, Joel?
It certainly isn't biblical. The Bible, in the biblical story of Noah, of course, there are plenty of women. Everyone's got a wife, as one of the callers put it. Mm-hmm. Noah has a wife and his three sons have their wives. But, I mean, not a single one of them speaks. So the issue of, you know, who is it who wants to preserve human life is not at stake in the biblical account. So, I mean, Aronofsky, I think, is making a very interesting point by putting that effectively on the women. Though, to be fair, it's Noah's fanaticism alone. I think his sons certainly don't share in it. I mean, a significant part of the story of the movie is his son Ham sort of desperate for a mate, desperate to sort of keep his line alive somehow. So, I mean, I think the fanaticism aspect that Ingrid mentioned and that you mentioned is really, it's not so much about men versus women. It's about the person who feels himself to be a prophet trying to wrestle with how real do I think this is, and how much stock do I put in my own view of what God wants from me, as opposed to what everybody around me seems to be saying.
And exactly how far will I go? It makes Hollywood-style dramatic tension here, maybe an unresolved element of the scripture itself. It gives us a chance to think that through, talk that through, and we're grateful for that. Joel Baden at Yale Divinity School, it's been wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Ingrid Lilly, executive producer of floodofnoah.com, theologian in her own right, joining us from San Francisco. Ingrid, thank you for your insights today.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.